Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. It's my great pleasure to introduce you Matt, who's our summer intern. So Matt has been working with me and our team on the emotion recognition for audio, and he has some very interesting ideas to share with you. So Matt is from University of Texas. He's like I think almost finishing his PhD soon. So without further ado, I just let Matt do the talk. Okay, thanks.
All right. Thanks, Jeff, for the introduction. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming to the presentation. As Jeff mentioned, the project I was working on during the summer was speech emotion recognition using only the acoustic and audio information. And I've put together a summary of the work we did and some of the conclusions that we had. So that's what I'll be talking about during the presentation. So here is a quick outline of what I will cover in the presentation. I will start with a very brief and quick background on the problem. What are the challenges we face? What are the common norms in emotion speech recognition, speech emotion recognition? And then I will give you a brief summary of what is the currently popular system for recognizing emotions from a speech. And then we will dive into the main part of the talk, which is what we wanted to do, and that is to automatically learn emotionally relevant features from speech using deep neural networks. So we can both learn short-term, low-level features, and also the kind of temporal aggregation into a more longer span representation. I'll talk about both in detail. And then also another important part of the talk will be how we can kind of zoom in into one particular part of the sentence which we believe has more emotional content rather than the other one. So we kind of believe this is one of the major contributions of our work. So the human speech is a very complex signal which carries much more information than the simple linguistic information that has the sequence of words that you say. It encodes information about gender, age, emotion, a lot of different things. So and for a human-machine interface, it is very important to kind of be able to recognize those emotions and to be able to respond accordingly. And the emotional state of the user kind of reveals itself in different modalities. It affects the facial expressions, voice characteristics, as well as the linguistic content, the actual what is being said. So you can use all these modalities. In this project, we are going to be exclusively focused on using voice characteristics. So we don't use we are not concerned with the words that were said. We are going to focus on the acoustic characteristics of the speech that was provided. So, and then this will have a lot of different applications. The most typical one would be automated call centers, where, for example, if you recognize that the user is in a frustrated or angry state, you can transfer him into a human agent rather than keeping him on the machine. So, there are many. In general, having information about the mental state of the user helps us to respond better to different situations. So what is the fundamental challenge we face here is that its emotions are inherently ambiguous and subjective. There isn't a very strong correlation between the perceptions of different people on what an emotion is, particularly when you only use the audio information. I think this picture really puts it the best way. In a conventional machine learning task, usually our concern is how to design the classifier. The labels are crystal clear. We don't have any problem with that. It needs some labor to collect them, but then there is no ambiguity in that part. So for example, in speech recognition, you just need someone to sit there and listen to the audio and then write down what he heard. But here in emotion recognition, the problem is that emotions are very subjective, and then there is inherent ambiguity in your labels. This is one problem we face, and so usually the typical agreement, like the accuracy of human predictions on emotions is usually somewhere around 70 or 80%, and that figure like kind of puts the like upper performance limit on what we can have. Yes.
When you said 70% and 80%.
Yeah, that's the problem. So these numbers are usually obtained by, so for example, when you ask a couple of people to read a sentence as happy, so your original intention is happy, and then you don't tell some audience what was the original intention, and then just make them listen to the audio, and then.
That data is like crystal clear
label. I will talk about it, why it's better to do something else. Just in the next slide, I'll probably mention that. So let's move to the data sets, and that will answer your question. There are three different types of data sets that are available for emotion recognition. So and they fall in different like places on how realistic they are. So the first category is just completely active data sets that, as I mentioned, you just, you know, literally ask someone to read a sentence with a certain emotion. So this gives you, the good thing about it is that it gives you complete like control over your collection. You can collect enough number of examples for each of your emotional categories. You can collect it in a lab environment. But the problem is that the expressed emotions will be highly exaggerated and unnatural. So another category of data sets would be the data sets that are a bit more naturalistic than that, because you actually ask two or more people to interact with each other, given maybe a fixed theatrical scenario or a certain situation to play with. So giving them this kind of context makes the overall expressed emotions more natural and more believable. So this is another set of databases, and the MOCAP database that we use for our experiments is one of this category. And the most realistic thing you can get is to actually go in a wild and go on the internet, go on YouTube, maybe download a couple of podcasts, and then look for emotional content in those. So this is as realistic as it can get. So these are the different data sets that we can use. And so in terms of the labels, we can label the sentences that we have in two different ways. We can use like a straightforward categorical labels like happy, angry, sad, those words for describing emotions. Or another approach people sometimes use is to give numerical scores to how active or passive the emotion was, or how negative or positive it was. So on you can kind of specify what the emotion is according to like where in this like activation valence space it falls. So this way you can like have a maybe more precise description of emotions. The problem is collecting that type of data is a challenge. So at least for the purpose of this project, we were mostly concerned with the simple categorical labels. And this is the data set that we perform experiments on. It's collected in the University of Southern California. It's organized in five different sessions. In each of which, two people are interacting with each other, maybe given fixed transcripts on a theatrical scenario, or just telling them to act something spontaneously. So, and then the categories that we choose are four categories: neutral, happy, sad, and angry. The database itself has more, but then the number of examples in those other categories are really, really small. So for our purpose, we are only focusing on these four categories. So this gives us almost 5.5 hours of data that we can work on. And then another important thing to know about the data set is that it's very precisely manually segmented into typically very short sentences, maybe a couple of words, maybe two or three words. So we will need this information in the later slides I will be talking about. So again, more information about the data. In the pie chart, I'm showing you the distribution of the different categories that we have. My intention here is to show you the kind of imbalance we have in the training set that we have, and this is a typical problem with most emotional data sets, particularly the realistic ones, because if you have some realistic data and ask annotators to flag them, usually as soon as they're confused, they don't get the emotion, they'll put neutral on that. So most databases are imbalanced towards the neutral category. And it's not only that. So here also, for the rest of them, an example here is that for the happy category, we have very few examples compared to the other ones. So this will affect our performance. And also, the other information here is the typical length, the distribution of lengths of sentences that we have, mostly focused on like 2 or 3 second files, because they have been very carefully manually segmented and annotated by different taggers. So how do we deal with the imbalance problem that I mentioned? There are two major things that people usually do in these kinds of situations. You can either oversample your training data in the rare categories, just augment the data by different data augmentation techniques, or you can use the so-called cost-sensitive approaches, where you just adjust the costs according to the frequency of occurrence of the corresponding label. So for example, in our neural network trainings, the most effective, and which is also the simplest thing you can do, was to just in one mini batch of costs, just to adjust the scales of these costs according to the number of examples we have in that category. And so using this simple approach in our case gave much better results than most of the oversampling techniques that we use. So we'll stick with that. And then also for the other like classifiers, when we are working with our support vector machine baselines, we can do something similar. So we can adjust these like C parameter in the SVM, which decides how you penalize the misclassification in each example according to the number of examples in that set. And so this is what we do in training to address the imbalance. In testing also, we should be careful, because we can get tricked by a classifier that only predicts the majority class. So we should be careful to kind of look both at weighted accuracy and unweighted accuracy. Weighted accuracy is like the normal overall accuracy. Unweighted accuracy is the average accuracy in each specific class, and that helps us better not get tricked with the problem I mentioned. So let's talk about what is the typical emotion recognition system do. The conventional speech emotion recognition system, this is like a figure that illustrates the overall process. You extract features from short time, like very short frames. And these features, we call them low-level descriptors. You extract some design, handcrafted features that people believe are influenced by emotions. Typical examples are fundamental frequency, energy, MFCC, zero crossing rate, voicing probability, those things. So you extract all of these low-level descriptors from each frame, and then at the end, you apply different statistical functions to each of these dimensions to somehow get a description of the overall temporal evolution of these, or the contours over time. So the statistical functions are like mean, variance, or sometimes the slope of the regression line that passes through these. So this way, you by using these, you kind of try to describe the variations in time, as opposed to the static short-term values. So the belief, the general agreement in the literature is that the emotion lies in those variations and contours rather than the static short-term values. So that gives you the final feature that you have, and then you can use a typical classifier, most popularly the support vector machine, to classify the final feature vectors that you have. So here I'm listing some of the typical low-level descriptors and high-level statistical descriptors, which are the statistical functions that I mentioned, that people use. A variety of different features on the spectral, temporal, prosodic, voice quality categories, and also a variety of different statistical functions. So the main research, the majority of research and existing literature in emotion recognition is focused on this search for emotionally relevant features. The problem is we don't know which of these features really get affected enough for emotion, and which of them are discriminative enough in terms of classifying the emotions. So Current most past research has been focused on this search for relevant features. And the recent trend has been to use a very large number of these low-level descriptors and a very large number of functionals, get this very high-dimensional feature vector at the end, and then use dimension reduction on that to get a feature for classification. So there are some recent efforts on using deep learning in emotion recognition. We are not the first ones who are doing this. And the problem is obviously the amount of data. We need more data when we are training these models, and it's a bit of a challenge with the typical amount of data in emotional databases. So the existing works are just replacing the final support vector machine with the deep neural network and then classify them. Use the same features with the deep neural network. And then there is some existing work that has been done here in the audio and acoustic group to kind of discover the relevant short-term frame-level features using either feed-forward nets or recurrent nets, but then following with the statistical functions and using extreme learning machines on top to do the classification. So what we want to do here, we want to take a closer look at both of the steps I mentioned in the feature extraction procedure that we had. We want to see if we can do better in discovering the frame level features, and if we can do better in kind of the temporal aggregation that we need at the end. So we start with the low-level, like short-term features. If you look at the list of the low-level descriptors that I mentioned, most of them are kind of inferable from the spectral representation. So when I look at the spectrogram of the speech, I can roughly say what is the familiar frequency. The formants are here. MFCCs are computed on top of that. So this is where we start for all of those features. So assuming that we have a fixed way of temporal aggregation over the whole frames, we should be able to, and also assuming that we have enough data, we should be able to start from this magnitude FFT values and then discover more emotionally relevant features using a few feed-forward dense layers. So it's important to mention that to know that the statistical functions that we had here act as different forms of pooling in time in the network. So some of them are like popular in popular pooling strategies in deep learning, like mean or max. Some of them are things that people typically don't use in deep learning, like just pooling the variance in time. But anyway, when we fix those, we should be able to kind of learn the frame level representation. And then I'll show you a couple of DNN structures during the talk. I've tried to be consistent with the color code so that you can, by looking at them, you can kind of know what their architecture is. The yellow is for dense layers and red for the final softmax layer, green for recurrent layers, and cyan for pooling, and input sorter are in gray. So this is the different structures we can use to discover the low-level features. So we can start with just the one statistical function, which is the average pooling, and then learn the features using dense layers. Or we can make the statistical functions more diverse, including other types of pooling. So here, I'll talk about accuracies and numbers more towards the end of the talk. I just wanted to like put these numbers here to just say that, yes, we can learn better features based on the magnitude of the spectrogram compared to the handcrafted features that people typically use in emotion recognition. So the red bars are the performance of a support vector machine using the handcrafted features, and the blue ones are using these structures that I'm showing here. And so another important thing to notice here is that as we make the temporal aggregations more diverse, we improve performance. So if you can have better temporal aggregation, you will learn better low-level features. So we will use this in the next part. So how can we do a better temporal aggregation? So we now just want to step on the second task. How do we learn the temporal aggregation better? The solution is to use a recurrent neural net. So the intention here is to, instead of having those fixed statistical descriptors, have a recurrent neural net that looks at past history and then decides what are the relevant statistics over these low-level descriptors that are relevant to what we want to do. This is the solution we are looking at. So this will be a kind of dynamic classifier that will kind of operate on the frame level, looking at each frame. This is going to be kind of fundamentally different from the previous systems. And obviously, if we don't have real-time constraints, we can make it bidirectional to use both past and future context. And so the way we look at it is, so we expect the RNN hidden representation to kind of automatically come up with the statistical integrations over the past frames that we needed for our temporal aggregation. And the way I like to think about it is usually thinking of the fundamental frequency mean. So this is one of the most popular features in emotion recognition. And so if we assume that this is an emotionally relevant kind of temporal description, and then fundamental frequency is one of the input features, we kind of expect after convergence, one of the RNN nodes will somehow integrates, somehow compute the average of this input feature over time. So this is the way we think about it. So the immediate challenge that we will have here, yes, go ahead.
Can you tell more about why do you use the future part in the bidirectional RNN?
So the data we have is, so we want to look at, in the end, we want to look at a whole sentence and decide on its emotion. So we
just decided at the end of a sentence.
Yeah, I'll talk about waiting until the end of the sentence, but that is independent of the direction you want to work on. You can just start from the end and wait until the beginning. So again, you have temporal context in that way. So I think it's possible to use bidirectional networks to use both right and left context.
My problem with this is, in the real time, if you want to process an audio.
Yes, exactly. That's what I mentioned. We are not concerned with real time operation here. We're concerned with utterance processing. You get the full sentence before you start working on. So yes, if you want to do it real time, you'll have to use the unidirectional, and obviously you lose some performance. Right. So. Let's go forward. And so the challenge we have here, how do you train the network? So you don't have frame level labels for your features. You have only one label for the overall sentence. So how do you train the RNN? This is the problem. The general things you can do, you should either kind of assign each frame a label. Maybe the most straightforward way would be to just assign the overall label to each and every frame. Or kind of combine the RNN hidden representations into one single sentence level representation, and then use that and compare that against the ground truth label that you have. So this is like the most naive thing that you can do, just assign the overall label to each and every frame. You can do it, but the problems, it has two different problems. So the first one is that, so as I mentioned, we expect the RNN outputs to kind of remember long-term information from the past. So kind of forcing the RNN to have the needed representation since the very beginning, and at each frame, it's not reasonable. So that's one problem. And the other problem is that we can't really assume that all of the different frames in a sentence carry the overall emotion. Although it has been tagged with, for example, happy, the annotator has probably just focused on maybe one or two words there which carry the emotional content. So it's not reasonable to assume that all parts of the sentence carry that emotion. So the next structure would be what I mentioned, just use these many-to-one RNN structures where you just pick the last frame. So this solves the first problem I mentioned, and that is you need sufficient past context until the RNN can kind of reach a good representation. The problem here is that, again, just focusing on this one single last frame is not reasonable. Maybe if we could assume that the emotions are like just the input features, the frame level features, kind of very completely constantly show the emotion from the very beginning to the end, this would have made sense. But then in practice, usually in one sentence you have these like variations of the emotion, and then towards the end of the sentence you actually lose the emotion. So the RNN outputs will kind of start to deviate from the representation that we needed. So this is the problem with this structure. The other thing you can do is to do a mean pooling over all the RNN representations. And this is pooling on top of the RNN. This is different from the poolings we were talking before. So and then get this sentence level representation and compare it against the grand Wolf label. So this in practice works much, much better than the two previous approaches, although it carries the same like inherent problems. Because if you average over all the frames, then you're just including a lot of maybe even silence frames. So even you have short pauses in your sentences, so you're averaging over all the short pauses and silences, as well as parts that weren't really emotional. So, but in practice, this still works better, and that's probably because, at least for this data set, which is very carefully segmented to very short sentences and annotated carefully, we have enough good RNN outputs to kind of dominate the overall mean. But inherently, it still has the same problem. What we wanted to do, the better thing to do here, is we could somehow discover which of these frames we should do the averaging, the ones that are more emotionally relevant. So that's what we want to do here. The main thing we want to focus on is how can we do something better than just an average pooling over the whole frames. And so we want these final weights of this weighted sum to kind of be able to focus on the parts of it, kind of zoom in on the parts of a sentence which are more emotional. So how do we do this? We were kind of inspired by what people in machine translation are doing these days, and that is just focusing on parts of the original sentence that are more relevant for each word in the translated sentence. So I'll just very quickly mention what is attention mechanism in machine translation, and then we will kind of see how we can map that into our problem. So this is like what people until recently used in machine translation. So you have two different recurrent neural nets, one as encoder and the other as decoder. So you feed in the sentence in the original language to the encoder, and then you get the final RNN representation as a kind of a code vector that contains the semantic information from the whole sentence. And then you use it as the initial value for the decoder, and kind of expect it to spit out the words that are in the second language, and so you just train this overall encoder and decoder structure using your training examples that you have. So you can do this, but then this has actually two problems. The one problem is that there is some sort of like prior knowledge about the task of translation, and that is there is some local relation. So we can maybe expect that maybe the first few words in the translated version are somehow corresponding to the first few words here in the original language. So we could somehow use this kind of information that we have, and at the same time, it's not reasonable enough to assume one. Single code vector here, which is their last RNN representation, can encode the whole meaning, particularly for long sentences. So, how can we like pay attention to this kind of a local information when we are deriving the code vector that we need for translation? People decided to do some kind of instead of just picking the last RNN representation in the encoder, just do a kind of weighted average over all the RNN representations. And then decide, and these weights will decide which part of the original sentence you want to focus on. So how do we compute these weights. So for each location in the translated sentence, you will look at what was the previous decoded word, which kind of provides the context for you. And then look at, with that, you look at every word in the original sentence to kind of discover what is the contribution of that that word in the location that you are concerned with in the output. And so your attention model is going to receive these two information, decide about the importance, and the attention model is usually a feed-forward neural net, and then this whole model, encoder, decoder, and the attention model is trained together using backpropagation by your training examples. So how do we use this in our problem? So in our problem, turns out it's actually much simpler than this because we don't have the decoder. You just have the one single RNN here that is looking at the emotional data. So, and also we don't have the like past context, which is the previous decoded word. So it becomes much, much more simple, and we can formulate it like this. So again, we have the dense layers and then the recurrent layers. So instead of doing the normal average pooling over time, we can have this parameter vector U, which is the parameter which parameterizes our attention model. And then kind of compute the inner product of that vector with all of the hidden representations of the RNN. So we do it at each point, and then you interpret this scalar at the output as the importance, as a kind of a score for the importance of that frame in the overall averaging. And then you pass this through a softmax operation so that you'll just convert from like raw energies to actual weights that will sum to one. And then go back to the RNN representations and then use those weights to do a weighted sum instead of the average pooling. So if you do this, then this will kind of let you focus on parts of the sentence which were more emotionally relevant. And then you train the attention parameters in you together with the rest of the network. So what I described as the attention model here is a simple logistic regression model as the attention model that we want to use here. But supposing you have enough data, nothing prevents you to actually use more sophisticated attention mechanisms. Maybe a deep net there in the attention model as your attention parameters. So in our case, still using the simple logistic regression gave better results. That might be because of the limited amount of data that we have. So we will stick with the simple vector of parameters, which is equivalent to a logistic regression as attention. And so the way we want to think about it is that this attention model will somehow try to remember the common patterns in the RNN output for emotional data. And kind of reject the rest of them and give them a low weight. So here, I just want to play a couple of audio examples for you to kind of have a feeling of what these weights, these discovered weights for the different frames through the attention model are. I think it's the best way of like having a feeling of what the system is doing and how we focus on local parts of the sentence. But before playing the samples, I just want to mention that this is looking at the weights. You can see that it has achieved one of the things that we wanted to do very good. We wanted to like ignore the silence parts that we had in a sentence. So it just automatically assigns very small weights to whatever silence we have within the sentence. But I was initially concerned maybe it's just doing that, it's just focusing on the energy. But if you look at this example, it's not just picking up the energy because this part of the sentence is actually more energetic, but then it has lower weights compared to this part which has less energy. So it's kind of trying to focus on the parts that are more emotional. And all of these examples are from the test set. These have not been seen during the training. So let's play the sad example here.
This is just this. I mean, it's a lot and everything, but it's not, something else. Am I making any sense?
So this one is a bit tricky. That's why I wanted to play these, and this kind of, again, puts the fact that Emotions are subjective. To me, it seems like all of the sentence is equally sad, but then somehow the network has decided that this first part is actually sadder than the rest. And I forgot to mention that so the way we interpret these scores should be, these are weights for the recurrent neural net output. So the recurrent net has actually looked at the past frame. So when we have a peak here, it doesn't mean that the emotion is like focused on that single frame. We should interpret it as more like we have emotions around that place. So this is the first example. The second example is like easier to agree with. That's an angry example, and let's listen.
It's a pity you didn't have a little bit more brandy. It might have made you less disagreeable.
So to me, the force he puts on the less disagreeable is kind of, maybe I'm trying to agree with the network, but the force it puts there, it sounds kind of angry. So maybe it makes sense to have more weights there.
So it's pure performance.
So this is from the EmoCap database, which is interactions between two people. So you tell two people to interact for a couple of minutes over a given,
in the script, they show their words, and also do the script of the emotion. They say, "Oh, now you say this, it's angry," or say this.
So the way, they make them play this, and then afterwards they don't rely on what they told them to play. They just use annotators to look at the sentences and tag them again.
During the recording, they are taught to say something with a specified emotion.
They act the scenario they are given. So they're told, for example, you are in the driver's license office, you want to get the driver's license, and the other guy says you don't have enough documents for that. So they act that. But then because sometimes they don't sound the way they should have in that scenario, they use taggers at the end. Yes.
Does the attention model actually attend to the lexical content or just like the low level?
No. We don't use any lexical information.
Yeah, but is it like, have you done it like to see if it has like more correlation with certain lexical words if you have the transcription?
So the examples that I listened to didn't really seem like it's focusing on lexical information. Sometimes the emotions really aren't in the words. Is in the way that the sentence was expressed, but to me it didn't seem like it's just focusing on the words. So,
if I were to listen to this without, suppose if I don't know any English, example, if I listen to this, I would not know.
Yes, that's the problem. That's why I wanted to play it.
It's
a consistent problem in emotion recognition from voice only. So a lot of times when I listen to these examples, I don't agree with the tag. But we kind of choose different, maybe five different taggers, and we get the majority vote between them, hoping that maybe that's the emotion. So this is the inherent problem.
I think like when they hire labelers, they should hire somebody who do not understand this language. Right? Then that would be consistent with what the machine is doing. Because right now the machine is not trying to understand the language. You pretend you don't understand language, but you only listen to this tones, basically.
That's true. If you could have annotators that only focus on acoustic information, that would have been
more fair. So
yes,
more,
exactly.
More consistent. That's what the emotional condition is.
Yes, true. Sure.
Do you think that these have any structure to them as they go through the utterance? Because a few slides back, you kind of implied that maybe there's some canonical structure that you may tail off at the end. But I'm looking at these now, and it seems kind of random, which I guess makes a little more sense than there being a typical structure to the emotion content to the utterance.
Yeah, so when I looked at the different examples, you can like have fixed patterns where there's no emotion, and then they start the emotion, and then they end the emotions. Usually it's like different regions with not a very predictable structure. So, and it's sometimes, so I've tried to choose some good examples here, but sometimes it's difficult to really agree why, weights have been placed on a certain local region. So let's hear these two more examples. I put two happy examples here. Let's hear the first one, and then I want to talk about the second one.
Oh, how ridiculous.
Oh, I don't think it's ridiculous.
Again, to me, this one sounds the ridiculous here was maybe expressed with a lot of energy and positivity. So, but the reason I put the second example is that it actually contains laughter. So this peak you see here is actually laughter, And then, so this might be because there has been really laughter in our training examples, and it has somehow learned laughter is a happy structure. But then maybe it's because there is like some acoustic similarities between laughter and happy speech. So let's listen to this.
All right, I'm sure.
So I was happy to see this example that, okay, we can classify laughter as happy. So let's take a look at the experiments and results. Some quick information about the experiments we ran. We were working on the EmoCap data. We used 4 of the sessions as training set and the remaining session as a test set. We use LSTM recurrent nets, including people connections and full back propagation towards the very beginning of the sentence. No rectification, no truncation of the gradients. We use rectifiers as the nonlinearity for the dense layers, mini batch size of 20 sentences. We had to use at least 50% dropout on each layer because that given the amount of data we have, that's the only way to kind of prevent overfitting. Yes?
So the sentences are not independent, right?
This
is from a conversation, right? Not just independent sentences.
No. This is a conversation played between two different people.
Yeah, so but your LSTM is just run on individual sentences. You're not considering the relationship between these sentences, is it?
No. Just working on each example independently.
As so training. I will try to do this like a second layer of RM over the conversation.
No. Just we segment the conversation into different sentences, have labels for that, and classify them. We go into sentence level.
Yeah, but you can put another LSTM over these sentences, right?
Yes, if you want to do conversation level emotion analysis, maybe you can do that. But maybe that's a bit tricky because maybe in like, I don't know. There might be scenarios where one party is happy, the other one is not happy. So putting a tag on the whole conversation might be tricky. But at least what we're concerned here is just individual sentences.
I think like in the, for example, in the call center, right? The server is always patient, never angry, but the caller is always angry. So if you do this conversational, it's not very useful. And unless you understand the context, if you don't understand the text, I don't see why it's useful.
There's separate channels in that example.
Separate
channels.
What do you mean by separate channels?
Well, you could only listen to one of the channels.
Yeah, that's what they're doing, right? You only listen to one channel. Oh, you mean like a multiple sentences?
Yeah, sure.
Like multiple sentences.
Okay. So, and then, For when we focus on raw frame level features, we use 512 point FFTs, and then when we are using handcrafted features, we use 32 dimensional features, which are 16 actual low level descriptors with their first order derivatives. And then as baseline, we use a support vector machine over the handcrafted features with a radial basis kernel. So this is the results of learning the frame level short term emotional features using fixed forms of pooling without any recurrence in the end. So we kind of took a look at this earlier in the talk. Here we have the numbers. So you can see that, as I mentioned, as the dense layers can discover better features compared to the handcrafted features the support vector machine uses for each of these ways of pooling. So let's go to the second set of results, which is like our point of focus more, and that is when we use the recurrent layer to learn the temporal aggregation. So I mentioned the two structures that are not very good to use, and that those are just assigning the sentence level of motion to each and every frame, and that's the blue bar. And then we have the red bar as when you just pick the last frame. So by last, I mean last and first, because we have bidirectional RNNs. So you can see that they fail to discover temporal aggregations that are as good as just the fixed ones we use with conventional systems for support vector machines. So the dashed line represents our baseline with the SVM. So the method that beats that those handcrafted features are is when you do a mean pooling over all the frames, and this is still not using any weighting or attention mechanism. It's just a simple pooling in time. So the next thing we want to look at is when you use attention. So if you use the attention method that I just described, you get the improvements here in terms of the accuracy. So these improvements are important, although kind of small, because we should pay attention to two different things here. So that we should keep in mind that we are sitting at 60% accuracy on emotion recognition from voices. So we are kind of close to that 70-80% human correlation and agreement, and we're close to where everything gets subjective and really ambiguous. So it's at this point, really, we should kind of fight for each little performance improvement. So here we're getting like 1% in the weighted accuracy and almost 2% in the unweighted accuracy improvement. And this also, the other thing is that, as I mentioned, the data we're testing here is collected in the lab and very carefully and precisely segmented into very short, mostly maybe 2-second files. Maybe just many of them have like, okay, yes, something like that, or maybe 2 or 3 words. So for them, so the amount of silence in these kinds of files are minimal, and they have been annotated by multiple different taggers, so it's a pretty clean scenario. If you want to use it in real world, you should scale up your training data, and the only way to do that is to actually go to on the internet and then maybe go on YouTube and then collect podcasts or YouTube videos, and then use the audio from there. So that realistic scenario, you'll end up with longer sentences, they have more noise, they have more silence periods in between them, and they have less defined emotions over the duration of the sentence. So there, you know, using the attention to focus on the local part will make better improvements. And so this is when we use the three different things that we want to learn together with it and try to learn all of the things together. So kind of an end-to-end approach where you start from the magnitude FFT features, you use dense layers to learn the short-term features, you use the RNN layer to learn temporal aggregation, and then you have a local attention model to focus on specific parts. And then put this all together and then use backpropagation to jointly train all of these parameters. So these numbers are slightly less than the numbers on the previous slide when we were using handcrafted low-level features, but the reason is that we are really, you know, using a limited data, and here we have two dense layers of 500 nodes, and also the attention model, and also the recurrent net, so a lot of parameters, and so given our the amount of data, it's kind of difficult to learn the whole task end-to-end. But then the important thing here is that the effect of attention is more accentuated in this end-to-end scenario. So when you use attention, you can get a, like almost 5% improvement in overall accuracy and 1% in the unweighted accuracy. So just let's review what we covered in the talk. We wanted to use deep learning to learn both steps of feature extraction for emotion recognition, both focusing on short-term features and also learning the temporal aggregation over time. We kind of saw that the kind of naive approaches where you assign each frame with the label or you just pick one single frame at the end doesn't work as good as you might expect. And then we also showed that if you use a simple logistic regression attention model, you can kind of focus and zoom in on parts of a sentence that are more emotionally relevant. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have. Yes?
So I have a general question, high-level question. So for this line of work, another approach will be you do voice recognition first, you give a sentence, and then you run classification on the sentence. This might not work because some of the sentences, like, it's hard to say the sentence is happy or not. But some of the sentences are very clear. If I say, like, my paper gets accepted, it's clearly happy, right? And
yeah.
I was just wondering what kind of, like, performance will this approach be? Do you have a comparison?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the sentence maybe. So some sentences, you know, have the emotional information encoded in the lexical content, linguistic content. Sometimes you're saying, you know, some words that by themselves do not carry emotion, but the way you say it has the intended emotion. So it probably depends on what you are testing on. But we didn't do anything here on converting to text and you looking at the words. So I wouldn't be able to say that for sure.
Just related to this comment, I think it's an interesting comment there. I thought you want to combine the sort of text. I mean, you suppose that people are doing the translation, right? You can recognize text. And at the same time, you also use your just audio features. You should combine them.
Actually, you want this. It depends on the scenario. Matt is absolutely correct. We did it on Cortana. And typically, you don't share emotions with the dumb machine, so the content, the text, is emotionless. Yes, you do have your emotions in speech. And as a result, we got a very minor improvement, regardless of the fact that we did a relatively good recognition of the emotions from text and from speech. You combine them and you get minimum improvement. For the IMOCAP, however, when it's a more natural human-to-human interaction, most probably in this case, you can get a gain in the overall emotion detection.
Yeah, I think at least from the sentences you play, it seems like if you understand the text, it will help. But of course, there are always cases where you can say the same sentence can be, like you said, for the same text, you can always say it in different modes.
Yes,
but
so.
I think that maybe a good realistic case is actually to get data from a call center. That's, I don't know yet. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of privacy concerns there. But still, that data is probably the best data to exercise this kind of technology.
Yes, that's true. And so the final goal here would be like to have a system that actually looks at all of these different modalities and then can derive. And because as I said, it's usually dependent on the actual example. So sometimes it's the words that have the emotion. Sometimes it's like the acoustic information. So if they provide complementary information, so if we can kind of fuse them into a single system, it should be able to do better. Yes.
Also, in computer vision, very often, for example, for image captioning tasks, they drive the attention mechanism based on the text. So you have like an image, and you recognize the text, and then you focus on the areas of the image that include this class. Like they drive the attention layer based on the text.
Yes, I think it will be possible here as well. If we had features from the text, we could incorporate them into the attention model. So, yeah.
Did you happen to look at the accuracy by category, the classification category? Did this perform better with happy or neutral?
So we did look at the confusion matrices on the different categories. It's the single most conspicuous pattern in that was that we were doing worse on the happy category, and the reason is the imbalance in the set. So we tried to overcome the problem of imbalance by adjusting the costs, but still, because we have fewer examples, we are doing worse on happy, which is the rarest example in our training set.
One more question.
Yes.
Do you think you could get any improvement if you were to train only on data where there was unanimous agreement from the taggers and then test where there was majority agreement?
So we are somehow doing that currently. So the data set comes with the tags from a couple of different annotators, and then we take the majority vote. Sometimes there is no majority vote, so we kind of discard that example.
But I mean unanimous, like every tagger agreed.
So
maybe just use those for training.
Yes, that if you have enough data to start with, that would be good. But then if I focus on that, I'll end up with very, very few examples. So in practice, at least currently with the amount of overall data, that's not possible.
And we try that for images. And the problem is that the images that all typically are treated. So some of the difficult emotional subtle emotion are the ones that tag have problem to abuse each other, which is the ones that we need to train on it more.
And another thing that I was talking with Cha was, we can also, instead of having a fixed majority vote, we can kind of model the distribution of the different taggers and cross entropy with that. That, I think.
Carlos also has a paper on that, judging the judges.
Okay. Yeah, so that should be able to do better, but at least for this work we focused on.
Did you try to run tests on other data set and see if it's transferable or if it works?
No, I haven't run any cross-corpus experiments. It should kind of, probably at least on realistic data set, it will perform worse than this because this is collected in the lab very carefully annotated.
But so. I wonder how much it could perform compared to baseline on the other data set without retraining on the, or fine-tuning on the other data set.
I wouldn't be able to answer that. I should run the experiment first and then.
One question regarding the use of LSTM,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's because for you guys, for your data, it's very short, right? It's only 2 seconds, and also the dependency or the temporal sort of correlation, it's not that strong. It's not like a native language, right? You have very, very strong correlation, temporal correlation. Right? So for the emotion kind of thing, I assume the major correlation would be, oh, if this frame you're happy, what next frame is you're happy? And even this frame, you have some, there's no sign, so the next frame is also not sign, right? You kind of have that kind of correlation. But that's pretty much it. I don't see any other kind of strong correlations in time domain, right? So I was wondering, and also because it's kind of short, it's not really that long, so I wonder if OSTM, how much that actually is effective for this kind of thing.
So the reason we use the LSTM layer is both for like using the like context on the inputs and also kind of looking at the conventional system and what we do there. So the general agreement in emotion recognition is that so the emotional information lies in the like temporal evolutions and contours rather than like fixed static short-term values. So one justification for using the recurrent layer there is to kind of estimate to do the same thing, kind of estimate these long-term statistics over the original short-term features.
So these are 25 milliseconds per frame, and even it's a 2 second video, you still have pretty long, large number of frames, like 80 frames.
Yeah, but the correlation is not, I mean, there's not a lot of temporal structure. An emotion context. In the text is different. The text is very strong dependency. Yeah, if you know this synonym, phoneme, the phoneme on this frame, you probably predict what's phoneme next frame. But for this one, some of the conditional dependency is not that strong.
We're not really importing any smoothness constraint in the whole. We were discussing about that. We didn't say the weighting has to be very smooth.
Yeah, we are not enforcing any like temporal smoothness, but as I mentioned, the way we should interpret those weights in the end is because those weights are on the recurrent layer output. It doesn't mean that we have a very strong concentration on the exact peak. It means that the recurrent layer has seen enough information that at that point it has gotten to a point where it produces the hidden representation that we need. Thank you.